Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for June 2014. This is issue number 353. I'm your host, Fred Bobe. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. My email address for general inquiries is fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. My telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. That number is not to be used for musings or to leave reports for the DX Audio Service. The musings number is 419-741-0205. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. Canadian members is now $30, and the magazine is published on compact disc. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. At this time, AM Radio Log number 34 is officially sold out. AM Radio Log number 35 should be out by Labor Day 2014. And speaking of Labor Day, still no word on a convention. It appears that nobody wants to host the convention. But those that attend want somebody else to host the convention so they can attend. So until somebody steps up and hosts the convention, no convention news is no convention. Some changes on my telephone in my house. Unfortunately, the politicians, nonprofit groups, and salespeople have made my phone a mess. When I get home, the answering machine is typically filled to the brim with messages, none of which are of any importance, and all during the evening, which is my usual time for recording in the studio, somebody is calling me trying to sell me windows, siding, or offering me deals or other silliness. I've decided to go to a call blocker, a device which tells callers, "We don't want telemarketers," and makes a legitimate person press 0 to reach me. I've also disconnected the answering machine, which is usually moot as it's filled with messages that I don't really want. And typically there's not any DX Audio Service or NRC business on it. If you need to reach me, the best time to call is either on the weekend during the day or between 7 and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Please do not use the musings line to leave messages, as that number is rarely checked until just before publishing time, and there's times that I don't even listen to the messages. Somebody else picks them up and edits them for the musings from the members. And no, I don't have a cell phone number you can call. If you need to reach me, please call during the time stated or send an email or a card or letter. Also, keep in mind that during the end of the month, when I'm putting together the DX Audio Service, it's difficult for me to carry on a long conversation. This is because I have a finite amount of time in which to publish the DX Audio Service, and if I'm on the phone, I'm not doing the DX Audio Service. It's not that I don't want to talk to you, it's just time management in order to meet deadlines, and often chatting on the phone will put me a few days or even a week behind in putting out the DX Audio Service. Hey, we don't want to keep this guy waiting any longer. He's got some important news for us. Here's Dave Alpert with a look at the AM switch for June 2014.
You're listening to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service.
Hi, everyone. Dave Alpert with the AM switch. This issue, we have one edition, AM switch, volume 81, issue 26. Call changes, 700 WTUB, Orange, Athol, Massachusetts. Change to WWBZ on April 30th. 1180 WWRX Hope Valley, Rhode Island changes back to WSKP. They had those calls from December 1st to December 24th, 2013, before trying WWRX for 4 months. 1320 WARL, Attleboro, Massachusetts, changes to WRNB. New station watch, change to pending CP granted for the station on 640 in Terre Haute, Indiana, for U2 250 watts day and night. That has been dismissed now. The new application was made to move the station to Piatone, Illinois, with U4 4800 watts day and 1150 watts night. The old CP had expired in February, and the new one will expire on July 29th. If activated, the licensee will take co-owned WMFN 640 Zeeland, Michigan off the air. Piatone, Illinois is about 50 miles due south of Chicago, 20 miles north of Kankakee, Illinois. Zeeland is up northeast of Chicago next to Holland, Michigan. So ends our geography lesson for today. Applications to modify existing construction permit 1250 KEWE Kalua'i, Hawaii applies to modify their CP to U1 5 kilowatts day and night on 1240, moving to a new site and diplexing with KAOI 1110. These applications for new station construction permits have been dismissed. The application for a new station on 1580 in Cutton, California. It would have been U2, 50,000 watts day, 1,000 watts night. Ditto the new application for a station on 1590 in Boise, Idaho. That application has been dismissed and would have been U2, 10,000 watts day, 2,500 watts night. The CP for 1210 in Osceola, Indiana on U4, 2,500 watts day, 219 watts night, expired April 22nd. No word on the FCC site as to whether the applicant filed for a license to cover the CP or it actually expired. Two more new station CPs expire in May. Craig, Colorado on 1450 expired May 18th, and Roe, New Mexico on 1420 expired May 19th. Stations going dark or not. 950 WNCC, Barnesboro, Pennsylvania. License canceled, calls deleted. WNCC has been silent since 2010 and says it surrendered its license in 2011, but the FCC only got around to acknowledging and confirming this now. 1310 WKSC, Kershaw, South Carolina. License canceled by the FCC. WKSC has been silent since January 2013. 1340 WNGM, Mountain City, Georgia. The license surrendered by letter to the FCC. WNGM lost their transmitter site lease and has been silent for more than a year. Same applies for 1400 WGHC, Clayton, Georgia. WGHC's owner surrendered the license because they lost their site as well. 1430 KCRX, Roswell, New Mexico. This station's license expired on October 1st last year when the station failed to file a license renewal application. The owner filed a late application explaining he overlooked the license renewal because the station has been silent since 2010 due to the explosion of a 10,000-gallon water tank on the studio roof, whereupon the FCC canceled the station's license for being silent more than a year. Construction permits for existing stations. CP's on the air. We have one, 990 KTKT, Tucson, Arizona. Their CP for U4, 10,000 watts day and 490 watts night is now on. CP's built and nearing final licensing. 660 WORL, Altamont Springs, Florida, applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 3,500 watts day and a kilowatt at night. 940 WCPC, Houston, Mississippi, applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 31,000 watts day, 7 watts night. 1170 WGMP, Montgomery, Alabama, applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 10,000 watts day and 4 watts night. 1410 WQBQ, Leesburg, Florida, applies for license to cover their CP for U1, 5,000 watts day and 88 watts night from a new site. 1470 WBCR, Alcoa, Tennessee, applies for license to cover their CP for U1, 1 kilowatt day, 77 watts night from a new site. 1490 KWOK, Hoquiam, Washington, applies for license to cover their CP for U1, 1,000 watts day, 760 watts night from a new site, and moving their city of license to Aberdeen, Washington. By the way, signal-wise, it might not be too much of a change, as the difference is only 3 miles. These CPs have been granted. 860 WTZX Sparta, Tennessee, granted a CP to U1, 950 watts day, 10 watts night from a new site. 870 WINU Shelbyville, Illinois, granted a CP to change their city of license to Assumption, Illinois. No change in facilities, just the city of license designation. That is, however, a 12-mile difference in city of license. Assumption is due south of Decatur. The station's transmitter is located between the two cities. 930 WEZZ Monroeville, Alabama is re-granted a CP for D1, 450 watts on 920 kilohertz, and a change of license to Brantley, Alabama. They'll diplex the tower of WAOQ, 100.3 FM. We're not sure if the night operation on 930 with 50 watts will continue or if they'll become a daytime station. 1030 WNVR, Vernon Hills, Illinois, granted a CP to U7, 27,000 watts day, 8,000 watts critical hours, 210 watts at night. 1230 WENY, Elmira, New York, granted a CP to U1, a kilowatt day, 910 watts night. 1270 WFLC, Fort Worth, Texas, granted a CP to change their city of license to Benbrook, Texas. No change in facilities. 1390 WZHF, Arlington, Virginia, granted a CP for U4, 9,000 watts day, 1,000 watts night, with a city of license change to Capitol Heights, Maryland. They will do this from a new site, the tower of WJFK 1580 in Morningside, Maryland, just a few miles east of Washington, D.C. 1480 WEEO Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, granted a CP for U1, 410 watts day, 9 watts night. 1530 WVBF Middleboro Center, Massachusetts, is granted a construction permit for U4, 5,000 watts day, 4 watts at night from a new site. The new site is more east and closer to Taunton, Massachusetts. 1580 KNIM Maryville, Missouri, granted a CP for U1, 480 watts day, 10 watts night from a new site. And 1590 WCGO Evanston, Illinois, granted a CP for U4, 10 kilowatts day, 2,500 watts night, raising their day power from 7,200 watts to 10,000. Applications for construction permits. 990 WGSO New Orleans, Louisiana, applies for U1, 600 watts day, 310 watts night from a new site, which is the WVOG 600 tower. Their old 990 site was on a roof of a building that'll soon be demolished. 1280 WMXB Tuscaloosa, Alabama, applies for U1, 5 kilowatts day, 35 watts night to replace an existing CP that expired April 28th. 1380 WKDM New York City applies for U4, 5,000 watts day, 13,000 watts night to replace an existing CP that expired. 1410 WZBR Dedham, Massachusetts applies for U1, 2,300 watts day, 25 watts night. WZBR just had a CP to move to 1410 U1, 610 watts day, 25 watts night, which was recently put on the air. 1450 KEST San Francisco applies for U1, 1,000 watts day, 960 watts night from the KSFB 1260 auxiliary tower. 1460 WRAD Radford, Virginia applies for U1, 5 kilowatts day, 37 watts night. 1580 WZVN Columbia, Pennsylvania applies for U1, 500 watts day, and 48 watts night from a new site. CPs canceled, applications dismissed. 1390 Bellefontaine, Ohio's application to move to Grandview Heights, Ohio with D1, 500 watts has been dismissed. That would have been a 50-mile move from what would have been Bellefontaine's only AM station on Ohio's highest point to the eastern suburb of Columbus, Ohio. 1510 WJKN Jackson, Michigan's CP for a new site, remaining D3 5,000 watts, had expired on June 5th, 2012, but was under review and is now deleted from the FCC database. The application for D1 380 watts is still pending. Special Temporary Authority, 570 WSYR, Syracuse, New York, applies for an STA with parameters at variance due to longstanding repair on the array, which is nearing completion. 600 WREC, Memphis, Tennessee, granted an STA with parameters at variance as their antenna monitor sample system is damaged and being repaired. 790 WAEB, Allentown, Pennsylvania, is granted an STA with parameters at variance. 910 WLTB, Marietta, Ohio, applies for a special temporary authority with U4, 500 watts day, 9 watts at night from their existing day site. WLTP lost their lease on the night site, which is shared with WHNK 1450. WHNK has troubles, which we'll hear about shortly. 1200 WEMM, Huntington, West Virginia, applies for an STA for 1,000 watts day, 9 watts night, so they can resume broadcasting to avoid losing their license. WEMM has been silent since vandalism to their tower site last April. 1300 WJZ, Baltimore, Maryland, granted an STA with parameters at variance. 1300 WOAD, Jackson, Mississippi, granted an STA with U1, 1,000 watts day, 950 watts night during tower work. 1310 KEIN, Grand Falls, Montana, applies for an STA with U1, 1,000 watts day and night from an alternate site due to storm damage at their old site, then subsequent legal problems with the landowner. The alternate site is about 6 miles away from their old site. 1370 KWRM, Corona, California, granted an STA, but said they're almost back to full power, finishing final tests. 1390 KCLN, Clinton, Iowa, applies for an STA with U1, 250 watts day, 35 watts night. It seems a vehicle collided with their number 2 tower's guy wire, resulting in a tower collapse. 1400 WJWF, Columbus, Mississippi, granted an STA with U1, 10 watts day and night. WJWF was a silent station due to transmitter failure and needs to get back on the air to maintain their license. 1410 WDOV, Dover, Delaware, granted an STA with parameters at variance, although day pattern is operating correctly at the moment. It seems they're having some problems with their phasing system. 1420 KRIZ, Renton, Washington, granted an STA with U1, 250 watts day, 125 watts night from the KYIZ 1620 tower. 1480 KBXD, Dallas, Texas, applies for an STA to use CP facilities of U4, 50,000 watts day and 1,900 watts night while continuing to await program test authority for the construction permit. 1480 WLVL, Pasadena, Texas, applies for an STA with day pattern parameters at variance. Applications to extend existing STAs were received from WMEN 640, Royal Palm Beach, Florida, WXQW 660, Fairhope, Alabama, KKOH 780, Reno, Nevada, WFTL 850, West Palm Beach, Florida, WRNS 960, Kinston, North Carolina, WALO, Hamakua, Puerto Rico. By the way, they requested U1 1,000 watts day and 5,000 watts night to overcome QRM from HICV in the Dominican Republic. Other applications to extend existing STAs, WSUA 1260, Miami, Florida, KKOL 1300, Seattle, Washington, WADB 1310, Asbury Park, New Jersey, WINT 1330, Willoughby, Ohio, WMTE 1340, Manistee, Michigan, WFNS 1350, Blackshear, Georgia, WVEI 1440, Worcester, Massachusetts, WKHZ 1460, Easton, Maryland, KOKC 1520, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and WYCL 1540, Niles, Michigan. Previously reported requests to extend existing STAs were granted to WWCS 540, Cannonsburg, Pennsylvania, WWNC 570, Asheville, North Carolina, WSNR 620, Jersey City, New Jersey, WAXY 790, South Miami, Florida, WFXJ 930, Jacksonville, Florida, WOFX 980, Troy, New York, WRFM 990, Muncie, Indiana, WLVZ 1040, Boynton Beach, Florida, KWAI 1080, Honolulu, Hawaii, KBBO 1390, Yakima, Washington, and WINW 1520, Canton, Ohio. Now time for a trip to the morgue to check the silent stations. Stations informing the FCC they are silent. 1450 WHNK, Parkersburg, West Virginia, has been silent since April 28th, when their transmitter lease expired. 1480 WQTM, Fair Bluff, North Carolina, is silent again as of April 16th, and looking around for a new program source. Want to program a radio station? Here's your chance. 1500 KDFN, Donovan, Missouri, has been silent since April 25th as their transmitter building roof is leaking, damaging the equipment. And although the FCC doesn't have it, Dave Schmidt reports WHYL 960 in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, is silent pending a sale. Formerly silent stations informing the FCC, they're no longer silent. 580 WYHM Rockwood, Tennessee, was silent since March 9th, but they're now back on the air as of April 23rd with repaired ground radials. 670 WRJR Claremont, Virginia, has been silent since October 13th, 2013. They're now on as of April 10th with an STA. 910 WPFB Middletown, Ohio, silent since December 24th, 2012. But they came back on August 24th, 2013, and have now been taken off the FCC silent list. 1200 WEMM Huntington, West Virginia, has been silent since April 25th last year. They're back on as of April 22nd this year with an STA. 1280 WMFR Pearsall, Texas, has been silent since September 30th. They're now back on as of April 22nd. 1310 KEIN Great Falls, Texas, was silent since April 25th of last year and just returned on April 23rd with an STA. Same with 1400 WJWF Columbus, Mississippi, back on April 29th. And a little twist, 1590 WGYA in Guayama, Puerto Rico, was silent as WXRF since September 13th. They're back on as of the 23rd of last month as WGYA. In other FCC actions, the commission entered into a consent decree with the licensee of KXRA 540 Carmel Valley, California, which broadcast a paid program without a sponsorship announcement, and that included indecent language. The licensee will make a voluntary contribution of $15,000 to the U.S. Treasury. The station is being sold to El Sombrador Ministries, which will convert it to a non-commercial station. Similarly, the FCC has entered into a consent decree with the licensee of WNTA 1330 Rockford, Illinois, for failing to disclose that the guests on Daily Talk Show Stateline Showcase had in fact been paid to appear and promote their products. The licensee will make a voluntary contribution of $185,000. Yes, you heard right, $185,000, and adopt a compliance program going forward. Two quick items pertaining to Canada. 1400 CIOR Princeton, British Columbia, is granted approval to convert CIOR to a relay of CJOR 1240 in Osoyoos, British Columbia. It had been operating as such without CRTC approval for a while. Now they're getting around to the formality. In 1690, CJLO Montreal, Quebec, applies for repeater on 107.9 FM. The AM will stay on, but this will supplement coverage in the downtown area. With thanks to Wayne Heinen, Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, Tony Fitzherbert, who's vacationing in Charleston, South Carolina, Fred Vobey, and John J. Rieger, That's our AM Switch for the month of June 2014. If you have any news to report, either call the Musings line at 419-741-0205 with the information, or send it to Fred at the address at the start of the magazine. We always want to hear about silent stations and those stations which were silent and are now back on the air. That's it for me here in sunny SoCal. Time to propagate up to the Twin Cities for the Band Scan with Mark Durenberger.
National Radio Club.
We recently came across an article written for Popcom by Andrew Ooms. Andy is a friend, a supporter of the radio clubs and DXing, and a DXer himself. His article was entitled Standby, and Andy has allowed us to edit for time, so we're going to bring you the highlights of that fascinating story. As someone interested in radio programming history and radio station history, especially that related to Chicago, I recently was an appreciative recipient of a great gift. At a yard sale in Payson, Arizona, a friend of mine bought a box of magazines published by Chicago radio station WLS more than 70 years ago. The magazine was called Stand By. Until 1941, WLS was at 870 on the dial. After the North American Broadcasters Agreement, WLS moved to its current position of 890 kilocycles. WLS was operated by Sears shortly after its beginning in 1924, and the company was happy to encourage the understanding that WLS referred to World's Largest Store. By the 1930s, Sears had sold the station to the Prairie Farmer Company. The Prairie Farmer, one of the company's products, was an immensely successful and respected farm magazine circulated throughout the Midwestern states. WLS's programming was thoroughly consistent with the company brand, happily accepting its urban audience, many of whom had moved to the city from the farm not too long before. But the magazine really emphasized its rural outreach during an era when rural America did not have nearly the access to mainstream media and culture that it does now. So what did the American farm family do during its evening leisure hours before the 1920s? It's a little hard for us to imagine a time when radio and television broadcasting was non-existent, and newspapers were hard to get on a timely basis for many rural readers. Rural evenings were spent playing games, making music, and listening to family members make music, reading, and chatting when guests visited. By today's standards, bedtime was much earlier. Stand By entered the picture as Prairie Farmer solidified listener loyalty by making its listeners part of the growing WLS family of staff and audience. The magazine contributed to a fabulously successful combination of city-dwelling, regional, and somewhat isolated, sometimes distant, rural listeners. With extremely popular country music programming, information services of unlimited variety, and an emphasis on a human, folksy, and charismatic staff, WLS was not the only station to utilize a magazine to emphasize being part of the listener's family, and probably not the only Chicago station to do so. The magazine began in 1935 with 16 pages and grew to 20 pages within a few months. It covered an extensive landscape, including recipes, sewing patterns, dress and hat sketches, and other homemaker hints pages, with regular writers contributing. Several folksy comment columns were included, some humorous, some personality-oriented, and some describing various station operations matters. Personal items about station staff, musicians, announcers, and technicians were published each week. Because so much radio programming was live, the staff was very large, including easily over 100 performers in addition to technical and administrative support personnel. Consequently, there was never a shortage of staff news items of various types. There were one or two humor columnists writing each week. A regular was Pat Buttram, later famous for being Gene Autry's sidekick on the CBS radio show Melody Ranch.
Gene Autry with Batting the Saddle a Day.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimpson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more. only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopie tie, I oh, rocking to and fro. Back in the saddle again. Whoopie tie, I go my way. Back in the saddle again. Feed on the lowly Jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopie tie, I oh, rocking to and fro, back in the saddle again. Whoopie tie, I go my way, back in the saddle again.
Each week, the program schedule for the following week was published. Surprisingly, by today's standards, a column of additional listening suggestions was also carried, which listed highlights of programs on other networks and stations. Apparently, the bond of being part of radio in the earlier days was greater than loyalty to a single station, even on the part of station management. During the second year of standby, classified ads began to appear and soon filled an entire page. Ads ranged from corporate, ways to make money, health remedies, to individual, need a live-in maid, have a farm for sale. A couple of comic strips were carried from time to time, always humorous, usually making sport of hillbilly ways and speech. WLS shared 870 and later 890 kilocycles with WENR, another venerated but now silent set of call letters. That occurred until the late 1950s. I remember hearing station identification announcements says WLS, WENR, Chicago, often, although I presume that during certain hours the calls were announced separately. The schedule for much of the time-sharing period for WLS was Sunday, 7 to 11 a.m. and 5:30 to 7 p.m., Monday through Friday, 5 to 2, 6 to 8, Saturdays, 5 a.m. to 3, and 6:30 to 11. The daytime gaps and the last evening hours, except for Saturday, belong to WENR. Although some technical and managerial employees of both stations knew and interacted with each other, otherwise the stations were entirely separate entities, with offices and studios at separate locations. Some of the interest in station news on the part of WLS listeners and subscribers is that DXing was a big part of the early years of radio broadcasting. The frequencies were much less crowded in the early decades than they were later, so distant stations were easier to catch. Quite a few stations were on frequencies occupied by no other station anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Also, many of today's sources of interference and static were absent or certainly less intrusive back then. Few stations, including those of the power and scope of WLS, broadcast after midnight, so those who did broadcast during the night through the country could be heard at tremendous distances. Some Chicago stations even voluntarily ceased broadcasting Monday evenings. They called it the silent night, so that Chicago listeners could catch signals from other cities. This was reciprocated by other cities that had differing nights of silence. WLS was heard to some degree throughout the country and beyond. Responses came from people in the Atlantic Seaboard states, the Far West, and several Canadian provinces. New Zealand and Australian listeners were also heard from. Listeners wrote from Hudson Bay and Churchill, Manitoba. We can only only imagine how appreciated radio was in those Arctic places, which were actually probably pretty good locations for catching North American and European signals. Now that we know what could be read in the station magazine, let's get on with what could be heard on the station. Music is the most famous aspect of the WLS Prairie Farmer years, specifically that which is now known as country music. Then it was more often referred to as hillbilly, western, or barn dance music. Interestingly, in its next format under different ownership, WLS was also famous across much of our country for music, its very popular rock and roll and top 40 programming in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. In the earlier years, Saturday nights on WLS were huge, taking over from WENR at 6:30 p.m. Saturday night. Programming segments typically included the Keystone Barn Dance Party, followed by the National Barn Dance at 7:30, carried by NBC Blue nationwide, winding down the evening with local programming. Again, the Prairie Farmer program came on at 8:30 with many of the same performers and the same music as the earlier segment.
Hello, 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 everybody, everywhere. How's Mother and Dad and the whole family? Well, say, just listen to that music. The stirring notes of Vaughan, Wisconsin welcome us tonight as the Alka-Seltzer National Barn Dance comes to you direct from the Wisconsin State Fairgrounds in good old Milwaukee on the shores of Lake Michigan. Yes, folks, thousands of friends and neighbors are gathered here to help celebrate. So let's do it right. Roll out that barrel of fun, boys and girls, but remember to make it a Milwaukee barrel.
Special nights like New Year's Eve had additional programming segments such as the Prairie Ramblers with Patsy Montana and Red Foley and the Hoosier Sodbusters, the Barn Dance Jamboree, Barn Dance Varieties, or the Hoosier Hot Shots.
Hezzy, Kenny, Frank, and Gaby, the Hoosier Hot Shots. Ben, are you ready, Hezzy? Okay, contact.
Broadcasting a Saturday night barn dance was not limited to WLS, although it was one of the first. One of the early, famous WSM Nashville Grand Ole Opry MCs, George D. Hay, already calling himself the solemn old judge at the age of 30, had first started at WLS. Other stations' Saturday night programs heard for decades, beginning in the 20s and 30s, included the Louisiana Hayride on KWKH Shreveport, the Midwestern Hayride on WLW Cincinnati, the Saturday Night Jamboree on WWVA Wheeling, West Virginia, and the one I grew up with, the Missouri Valley Barn Dance, WNAX Yankton, South Dakota. Famous or moderately famous WLS performers or guests appeared on the Barn Dance, including frequent visitor Gene Autry, Red Foley, first of a three-generation set of music chartists, his son-in-law being Pat Boone, his granddaughter Debbie Boone. There was Arky the Arkansas Woodchopper, the Novelodeons, Jimmy Dean in his pre-sausage days, the Maple City Four, again, Patsy Montana. One listener wrote that she had written down the date and time of over 700 songs Patsy sang over WLS over the years. There were the Hometowners, the Sodbusters, the teenage George Goble, long before his mean old Alice days, the Prairie Ramblers, the beloved Lulu Bell and Scotty, there was Uncle Ezra, and there was Smiley Burnett. Most, if not all, of the music on WLS was country. The NBC Symphony was on WENR, and popular music was left to other Chicago stations. Listeners' letters were almost unanimously in favor of old-time music that was called country, and no other. Occasionally, someone would write in asking for a greater variety of music and would get resoundingly berated in subsequent letters. Many in the vein of, don't you have a way to change stations on your radio if you don't like WLS? Farm families far and near were not the only deeply appreciative listeners. Many letters came from aged or disabled shut-ins whose radios made a huge contribution to their quality of life. Each year, the magazine listed hundreds of radios that WLS donated to orphanages, hospitals, senior citizens' homes, veteran homes, and schools. A picture was occasionally published showing groups of grateful orphans or others, some as far away as Nome, Alaska. In addition to Saturday nights, WLS broadcasts live country music every morning for several hours, interspersed with farm market news, other news, weather, and chit-chat. A studio organist and storyteller named Ralph Waldo Emerson, after his ancestor, essayist and philosopher, was a popular daily performer. Weather for the ships on the Great Lakes was presented daily for a time, and its cancellation was greatly objected to. Farm news was huge. Livestock and grain prices were as interesting to many people as the Dow Jones averages to many of us today. Crop predictions, agricultural advice, and down-home events in various areas were essential for the business of farming and a lot of fun for some as well. Gardening tips for farm and city dwellers were popular. Listeners sent in seeds and plants for identification, and sometimes samples of crops for the staff to identify or enjoy. A plant grown from seeds dropped by migratory birds was one enigma to be solved and identified by the highly regarded WLS agricultural experts. Matters of faith were an important aspect of broadcasting in those days, when most country music programming on any station included a hymn toward the end of each hour. WLS had morning devotions daily, a Sunday school review program on Saturday morning, and several hours of Christian programming on Sunday morning. All of the devotional programming, including the Sunday morning block, was live and in studio. Remote broadcasts from local churches and national religious programming was not a part of WLS in those days. WLS carried several newscasts daily, 5 to 15 minutes in duration. At that time, news on the hour or on the half hour had not been initiated on any stations. Stations had three or four shorter newscasts daily, but network stations carried some high-profile commentators on the news nightly. WLS, being replaced by WENR most evenings, does not appear to have had a national commentator during the mid-1930s. Of course, its farm news was extended during the breakfast and lunchtime shows, likely not limited to 15 minutes, when the markets or weather or farm-related events were newsworthy. WLS newsman Herbert Morrison is remembered for his recorded broadcast made while he watched the Hindenburg Zeppelin burn and crash on May 6, 1937.
The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from bursting the flames. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. Oh, the humanity and all the passengers screaming around it. I don't do it. I can't even talk to people and spend it on there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honest, it's just laid there, massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and scream. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside where I cannot see it. Darling, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost my voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
Although WLS did not carry the virtual wall-to-wall soap operas that WBBM and WMAQ did Monday through Friday, they did have the popular Ma Perkins and Pepper Young's Family in the mornings. As did most stations in those days, the station carried a great variety of special events and speakers on a large number of subjects, including health, gardening, government, education conventions, child-raising issues, and business. College debate teams covered current political and economic issues. Special events carried included opening ceremonies for the 1936 Olympics, frog jumping contests, Queen Mary's first voyage, and a sun eclipse tracked from several locations. Due to an infantile paralysis concern in 1937, the beginning of school in September was delayed for several weeks. During those weeks, WLS and five other Chicago stations broadcast class sessions. Chicago newspapers printed the class schedules. Although WLS did not have many live play-by-play sports broadcasts, Stand By listed the events carried by other stations. baseball wasn't mentioned. College football was prominent. Northwestern, Illinois, and Notre Dame games were well covered, especially home games. Rose Bowl, Sugar Bowl, and Army-Navy games were carried by the networks. As you might guess, 160-plus magazines of 16 to 20 pages each contain enough information to make a summarization go on and on and on. I have gone on and on. There's more I haven't covered, but I'll finish this with my expression of appreciation for your attention to this scan of an example of an extremely popular interactive media situation that occurred long before interactive media became created as a phrase.
Next Saturday night, folks, we'll be back in the old WLSA loft in Chicago. We've planned an old-fashioned moonlight party for the occasion, and we hope you'll all join us. Until then, this is Joe Kelly saying good night and good health to you all from Alka-Seltzer.
And that story for Popcom magazine was written by Andy Ooms. And I might add a personal comment, or rather a question. When you listen to what WLS was doing in those days, and you listen to what WLS is doing today, do you think perhaps their earlier broadcasting was more of a public service? Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We'll be back in 30 days to wrap up that bandscan we were doing from the Pacific Coast. Until then, good listening, DXers.
What's the biggest need after a major natural disaster occurs? Communications. And when tragedy strikes in a remote area internationally, a group called First Response Radio can establish a local broadcasting station providing news and official information in as little as 3 days upon arrival. Mike Adams, the director of First Response Radio, recently spoke with Kirk Harnack and Tom Ray on the podcast This Week in Radio Tech. What you'll hear is a portion of the interview detailing why First Response Radio was founded and how it mobilizes when it's needed.
Let's just jump right in and bring in our guest for this week. It's Mike Adams, who's talking to us from a location just outside of London, England. Hey, Mike, welcome in.
Hi, Kirk. Hi, Tom.
Tell us a little bit about what you do with First Responder Radio. What's your position there?
I've been working in radio for over 25 years and mostly in Asia. And I was part of a group in Asia before the 2004 tsunami. And we'd been kicking this idea around. Wouldn't it be a great idea to use radio in disaster? And then now we have to say which tsunami we're talking about even. So the Boxing Day 2004 tsunami was really kind of our launch point. We'd been talking about it. We'd been thinking about how important radio could be in disaster. And when then that struck, some of my colleagues said, man, this is the time. We have to get involved, even if we're not ready. We don't really know what we're doing. We should give it a try and learn, make it a learning experience. We saw how powerful radio was to help people rebuild their lives. They just were desperate for information. As soon as we got on the ground and put a radio station on the air in the most affected community there in Indonesia, but it took us a month. It took 30 days roughly to get an emergency station on the air. And what I learned in that very first experience is, yes, people need radio. They need information as fast as possible. And a month is way too slow. We have to figure out how to do this in 72 hours. And so that's our goal now, to get an emergency radio station on the air anywhere in the world within 72 hours of a disaster. And First Response Radio is a network of radio, government, and humanitarian organizations that have pulled together to figure out how to do this. So that's the key introduction. How do we get on the air in 72 hours? Explained in 72 seconds.
When a disaster strikes, the role of First Response Radio is to start broadcasting information to the affected community within 72 hours. Information saves lives, whether it be about food, water, medical help, or locating family. Because there's usually no electricity, television and the internet is out of the question, but wind-up radios can be distributed anywhere. Broadcast also works two ways, giving a voice to the community. Getting the radio station on air in disaster requires both kit and training. The first piece of kit is a studio in a suitcase, equipped with everything needed to run a radio station. Then add to that a transmitter in a box, and an antenna in a piano keyboard bag. Portable and can be carried on any airline in the world. The training teaches a small team of radio professionals and NGOs how to use the kit, in the classroom and then in a field trial. The teams are then ready to deploy and respond to the next disaster. They have responded to flooding in India, earthquakes in Pakistan, and volcanoes in Indonesia. First Response Radio, ready when disaster strikes.
Can you expand on some parts that you'd like to talk about?
There's only three things that we do, and it's so simple and it's so profound. We just figured out that there's no way to be ready for disaster unless you're ready for disaster. Just buying equipment, for example. I mean, I went to place an emergency order. Yeah, we've got that stuff for 4 to 6 weeks delivery. And it was something that I commonly heard. Well, if we need to be out the door tomorrow, we have to have the stuff yesterday. And so we just decided, first thing, we have to have the equipment that we need before we need it. Buy the equipment. So there's a range of stuff we've got in our kit here, and we're going to go through that a bit later, what's really in the kit. So that was the first thing. And, you know, I'm the engineer. I've been doing radio engineering for over 25 years in Asia, and I'm with Far East Broadcasting Company. They're one of the founding members of First Response Radio Network, and they've released me to be the network coordinator. So I've done a lot of radio, from microphone to antenna. And being an engineer, I thought, this is the cool stuff, right? This is the important stuff. We have to get the kit, the equipment first. And I realized it was just, you know, that was the little 10%. That was the bit of the iceberg that you could see. And there's a lot more to it, even once you've got the equipment. So we had to figure out, what do we train people to do and to say in disaster? So we put together this 5-day class where they're, you know, they're still sleeping in a nice bed. We're in an air-conditioned, you know, building. We're having a training in the capital city somewhere. And after the in-class training is done, then the magic starts. We go to the field exercise or field trial. We go out and we do this. It's like ham radio field day then, Tom. This is, you know, the broadcast radio version of going out and doing it for real. We spend 3 days in the field with this field exercise, making it as realistic as possible. We want to do an on-air test, but we don't want to get into what I call the Orson Welles War of the Worlds scenario. This is a disaster, but it's not really a disaster. And so we have to have a real disaster zone that really did have some impact recently, and talk about what had gone on just before. So in the Philippines, easy to find disaster zones. In our first training event, we went to a volcano that had erupted recently within the year. There were still people living in the displacement camps, still very realistic disaster environment. And we got on there and we actually broadcast, you know, what was it like last year when the volcano blew up and the mudslides happened and so many hundred people were killed? We talked about people's needs for information and the situation, just looking back. But it's live, on the air, real exercise. And I draw on some of my experience from the military, training with the military. Make everything as realistic as possible. Use the equipment with the people in the environment, and that's where the magic starts to happen. All the people who are who've just met each other that week, radio people working with government people, working with, you know, World Vision or Red Cross people who've never met before. They're all learning from each other, and you get them out in the field, and you put them into the field for 3 days, and then they learn to work together. They get the skills. They get the confidence. Like it says at the end of the video, they're ready to respond. They're ready to roll out the door when the next disaster strikes.
Of course, the engineer in me wants to know all about, okay, what are you doing? What's the mixer? How do you have your wires set up? How do you bring you know, external microphones into it? What about field reporting? Because I saw somebody out in the field talking. Tell me about the transmitter, and tell me, how do you figure out what frequency that you're going to be on? So, well, let's say we just had a disaster in Chile, right? Day or two ago, yep. Right? That earthquake. I take it you're not sending anybody there. Maybe not needed.
That's right. We're not responding to the Chile quake right now. We're really looking at building capacity in Latin America, in Spanish speaking, you know, Latin America. And so we've got a partner identified. We want to get them on board and do some training, and then kind of franchise them with all the equipment and the training package and turn them loose on Latin America. So we see the need. I've traditionally been working in the Far East and Asia, South Asia, but yeah, there's a need there. So, I mean, we could work it backwards. Say we saw that need 2 years ago. We would have already gone down there and done some training. We would have already left all the equipment behind. There would be a local team, either in country or in region, that would be able to respond. So the response, so mechanism, looks like, how do you get on the air in 3 days? Day one, you make a decision. Are we going? Are we not going? Do they need us or they don't need us? Day two, you know, you travel, you deploy, you get to the capital city near the affected area, you get out to the regional capital, you get nearby, you get into the disaster zone, and then setting up, choosing your place of operation, getting down to City Hall or the Emergency Operations Center, wherever the central command post is, wherever the buzz is happening, that's where you need to be. And that would take the third day maybe to get there, get set up, and get on the air. That's what the scenario would look like.
Let's start this from the beginning. A disaster occurs. How do you get permission, or how do you start working with people to get from point A to point B?
Well, I think the Philippines was a pretty good example. So we did just deploy to the Philippines typhoon. We'd already done a training event. We already had some equipment in country. So we were, you know, we were ready to respond. And so in the field exercise, when we did the class back, you know, several years ago, when we did the training exercise, it includes live on-air broadcast. So we already have negotiated with the government years ago that whenever we do training, we need broadcast licenses. And when disaster comes, we're going to be needing licenses, and we're going to be needing them fast. And so several years ago, we came to this agreement with the licensing authorities in the Philippines, the NTC in the Philippines, their version of FCC. They said, look, we've got five kind of frequencies set aside. When you've got when you need to deploy, you call us, and we'll make sure you get a license within 24 hours. That was the sort of the gentleman's agreement, and it's all relationships. We know the guy who's the chief engineer at NTC. So here's how the international, you know, here's how the coordination went. Our local partner, Dan, in Manila, calls up chief engineer Alvin, and he goes, hey, Alvin, we're going to deploy. We need a license. Oh, yeah. What frequency do you think you want to use? How about that 98.7, the one we use in Manila? Can we use that down in Tacloban too? Yeah, that's great. That'll be fine. Just go. What about the paperwork? Never mind. Just go. Paperwork will follow. And so within 30 seconds, short call, it took about that long. I watched Dan talk to Alvin, and we had authorization to be on the air on 98.7, and we were out the door. So it doesn't start the moment. It starts, you know, the year before when you build these relationships. All these things happen when you do the training event in advance.
Have you had a situation yet, Mike, where you haven't had anything in place or any relationship and you wanted to go in? Is it possible for you to get in and start helping, or is this something that always has to be kind of foreplanned?
It's in the very beginning when we started doing this, I thought it would be, you know, the international rescue type model where people fly in from out of the country, come in and set up, and then fly out when it's all done. And when we did that first training event in the Philippines, right away I saw it was all wrong. So we have always responded with trains, with teams that we trained in advance. We wanted to respond in Myanmar, Cyclone Nargis 2008, and there were so many barriers, man. That was a whole different government. That was a whole different regime. It was we talked to some local partners. We thought about it. We went, man, there's no way we're getting in there. We aim to work ahead. It's not hard to identify disaster-prone countries. We really do like to build capacity in advance. Having said all of that, in the stairs underneath my house here, I've got a complete radio station kit. From London, I could deploy anywhere in the world and train people on the fly. We did do that in the second phase of the Philippines disaster response. When our first team was all worn out and had to pack up and go home, I flew in with a second set of equipment and trained some people from some radio broadcasters, trained them from scratch in the second phase. So, and I saw how challenging it was. We really like to build teams in advance. When the emergency phase of a disaster is ended, there's this initial stage where people's lives are still at risk. People don't have water yet or food or shelter yet, and things are really unstable. We will always stay through the end of the emergency phase. And as they transition into ongoing recovery and things stabilize, we'll look for things like, is there another radio station coming back on the air that can fill the role? How smoothly are things going, you know, with communications in the community generally? We tried to pull out at 6 weeks, and the UN group that we worked with, the UN coordinator, and they said, Mike, you guys can't possibly leave. This has been so successful, and it's filling a gap that's still really big. We really need you to hang around a little bit longer. So the first team shut down and went home, and I got a second set of kit, brought it, trained up another team, which came in. A worse disaster means you gotta be there longer. And we just wait till the indicators are right that someone else is filling that communications gap or the need is less. And some disasters that are worse, you've just got to stick around longer.
If you would like to hear more of this interview, it's available on the podcast This Week in Radio Tech, distributed by the GFQ Network. The podcast about first response radio can be found on episode 207 and was posted on April 9, 2014. This Week in Radio Tech has more than 200 podcasts related to radio broadcasting, many with video. You can find them on the internet at www.thisweekinradiotech.com. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Wally Warrow in Dallas, Texas.
Thanks, Wally. Who said old school is dead? A famous Swiss tape recorder brand to reintroduce reel-to-reel analog recorders. This article is by Michael Femmer on Analog Planet, May 16, 2014. Not allowed to divulge the brand name, but a famous Swiss company renowned for its pro audio and semi-pro reel-to-reel tape decks will begin again next year manufacturing a reel-to-reel tape deck. As unlikely as has been the vinyl resurgence, this news is even more unlikely, yet it's happening. Why? Because of increased demand for reel-to-reel tape playback and the willingness of record labels to license titles for reissue on 15 IPS half-track 10-inch reels. These tape sets are very expensive, yet the demand grows. For example, the Oscar Peterson set, also reissued on a 6LP set mastered from analog tape by the appropriately named AAA label in Germany. The recordings were originally produced by the well-regarded MPS label that recorded many jazz greats during the 1960s and beyond. A spokesman at the booth selling the tapes, or at this point just taking orders, said the demand has far exceeded the company's expectations, and based upon it, it expects to dig deeply into the MPS catalog for future tape releases. Getting raw tape is no problem, he told me, because somebody has bought the BASF tape manufacturing equipment in the unlikely event that this might just happen. So what company do you think is going to produce the machines? Tandberg, Revox, Studer, Nagra, or somebody else? Give us a call on the Musings line and let us know. That puts the wraps on part one of the DX Audio Service for June 2014. We'll see you on part two with Musings, Market Scope, and a lot more stories. Right now, let's switch back to 1963 in Chicago, Illinois.
Slow down and live. Sincerely, WJJD.